go ahead and start this. So I guess your first boat that you used for shrimping was the Marigold.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It was a 68-foot vessel that you and your brother used out of Seward?
Right.
Or Cordova?
Out of Seward.
Seward?
The way that came about, I'd been in Alaska, been working up there in Seward since about 55. In 59, I got drafted. And at the time, I had 2 airplanes and a new car. They wouldn't allow me to bring anything down to the lower 48 with me, so I told my brother to sell them. I'm just sitting there idle for a couple of years. Buy a boat, so he bought the Marigold. That was built in 1898. It was a yacht, built as a yacht. It was owned at one time by Rex Beach. Clairbo owned it for a while. We bought it from a guy in town that had been using it as a future boat, a charter boat.
Right.
Taking people out fishing. That wasn't very big in those days. We got a pretty good price on it. Shrimping was just getting started. Halibut producers go off and built a salmon receiving station there in Seward, and we wanted something else to do. And we started, Oral put together the trawl package on the boat. Started dragging shrimp, Resurrection Bay and Day Harbor and High Alec being close places. Mm-hmm. They were hand peeling in those days, so they couldn't handle very much.
Right.
And, shrimp, lots of shrimp. They decided to go up the mechanical feelers that had just been developed at that time. And they brought some mechanical feelers in. Things started moving pretty good, and we started moving further out, looking for better grounds and cleaner fish. So.
I guess now they don't use draggers that much for the shrimp up here. They use traps, not traps, but.
Well, shrimp is pretty dead all right. Over the state. Sitka's got a few small draggers working. Petersburg actually has a real high quality product there, limited amounts. That's about the only place in the state. Even the pot fish from Prince William, Katchamack Bay, pretty restricted. Now it used to be a 500,000 pounds of quota. Now I don't even think they own it anymore. At the Marigold, I came home on leave and spent a month on the boat fishing it, then went back down to Texas. We'd had a chance to get into another boat, the Vida. So we put a skipper on the Marigold, and Oral went over on the Vida. We co-owned it. That was still in the Army. Boy, I think it's really starting to go over the LM. A lot bigger boat, a lot more maintenance. Just too much for one person to keep up with. So I asked for an early out. I was short timer by that time, so I asked for an early out. We were up in Colorado by then. They gave me an early out. We drove back up the highway, got on the boat. Worked a little better because 2 of us were taking care of it. For 6 months that year, I earned about $1,300 with $1,400 in the Army. Second 6 months that year, I earned about $1,200 on the boat. We kept her together, kept going. It just never get ahead. I never could get ahead on the maintenance. So. There was a third partner in the boat with us, and we just gave it to him. We'd already sold the Marigold. The guy that we had ran it up on the rocks and pulled it. We didn't have time to take care of 2 boats, so we sold the Marigold. We gave the Vita to the third partner. Had a chance to get the Celtic at the same time.
Right.
And that was a schooner. Helped. Bought that with the third partner also. That was total price. Fishing gear, nets, everything was $35,000. 65-foot schooner, about 70-foot overall. Boy, that was a great little boat. Any kind of weather. Started running over to from Seward to the Kodiak ground and run up into Homer in the wintertime. Deliver back into Seward. Just a tremendous boat. Did real good with it. Shrimp markets collapsed. They had a bunch of bad shrimp come in from Thailand. Same thing as the salmon botulism. You know, just turned everybody off on shrimp. Markets collapsed all the same. We started hunting seal. There was a bounty on seal at that time. We were taking seal noses. So a guy came in from Germany, out Bonn, Reventlow, Pacific Seal Company. He offered us, you know, to buy the hide from us and showed us how to take care of the hard salting and packing the hides in the chairs. Started out averaging about $10-$12 a hide. As more people became interested, more people started hunting, more buyers started showing up. We were getting up and we were after $30-$40. You know, that picked pretty lucrative. We were able to make full payments.
Yeah.
We did that all one winter, and the shrimp started picking up a little bit again. Not in Seward, but over here. Kodiak. Then finally, Seward started picking up a little bit. We started getting back into shrimp again. Mm-hmm. And had to overhaul the engine. We were tied to the dock there. Coral came over here to run the fortress. And I was working with the cat people rebuilding the engine. I got a call from him. He said, pick me up in Anchorage. I'll be home tonight. So picked his wife up. We drove up to Anchorage. Picked him up that afternoon. Dragged him back down the highway when the earthquake hit. Right at mile 38 there, just outside of Moose Pass. Boy, those trees started whipping, the mountains started coming down, roads were bouncing all over the place. Stopped the car, and, you know, still bouncing all over the road. You know, it seemed like it took forever, but then when it calmed down, we got back to the car. That had the radio on an anchor station, and all we were getting was static. Fiddled with the radio and tried to rest the stations, nothing. My immediate thought was, God, they finally nuked Anchorage.
Yeah,
it's right in the middle of that Cold War era. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, here we go. There's no mushroom clouds or no flash or anything, so we started on down the highway. The bridges were broke, but they were far from our side going toward Seward. The pavement, the joint still butted the bridges. But the bridges were all tilted.
Right.
So there was a drop off on the far end of the bridge. And I just backed off with that Chevy I had, and I'd jump off the bridge down onto the, like the Dukes of Hazzard. We got down to mile 18. That bridge was down. That was a great big long bridge. There's no way we could get across that. So I parked the car there by the on the embankment. Walked down, dropped down the cliff to the railroad, and we knew there was another bridge on the railroad that had crossed the river up the hill, and we could walk under the sewer. We're walking down the right-of-way there. Boy, the rails were just twisted, you know. All the connecting bolts were sheared off, and trees were split. About halfway over to the railroad bridge, see a guy coming the other way. Met up with him and asked him if the bridge was intact. He said, oh yeah, no problem. Asked him where he was headed. He said, well, got to get back to Moose Pass. Asked him, you know, how far he had got. He said, well, 12 miles, and then I dropped down and went back to 12 Mile and picked the railroad up, figured I'd walk in. Got a truck parked up there. I'll tell you what I'll do. Trade your keys. So he picked my station wagon up there at 18, and I picked his truck up at 12. 6 weeks later, they finally opened the road up again. We exchanged keys and cars. I had his for about 6 weeks, and he had mine. Worked real good for us. Got picked that truck up at 12. Came down over the hill there where we could see sewer. It was getting pretty dark by then. All we could see just a mass of fire all the way around town. Looked like the whole town. We had family in town. My wife, my baby, mother and stepfather, Oral's daughter. Well, we just didn't know what we were walking into. We got down to mile 3, most bridges were out too, so we had to walk on in. People were milling around, you know, couldn't get into town at all. We go up to the Jesse Lee home, that's where the refugees are going. Mm-hmm. We went up to the Jesse Lee, we found everybody. We didn't see anybody in here. We stayed with friends, for about a week, 14, 15 minutes. In each house around there.
Yeah.
And then we got the roads open and stuff. We got back into town. And Salvation Army really helped us out. We were wiped out completely. Celtic had left it tied to the dock there. We told the harbor master before I left. I got the drag cables. I ran them out around the piling and hook them into the box because, you know, that boat was in the place the box was going with. By God, we found the boat up on the road to the airport and there were still pieces of the dock tied to it.
Was there any early warning at all for the wave? Or
no. My wife and the baby was in the trailer house down there. Right on the edge of where the new boat harbor is now. It was from there on towards town, the trailer park was. But the tidal wave, or the earthquake hit, and when the fuel tank started exploding, he knew immediately that it was an earthquake. My brother-in-law was in the trailer right near him, and he ran over. And to the day he died, he claimed he didn't, but he ran over and warned everybody that a tidal wave was coming. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't remember doing it, or didn't remember doing it. But they all started getting in cars, and the first wave hit while they were still in the trailer house, knocked the candle off just a little bit. Wasn't the real bad there. So they got in my stepfather's car, and they were driving some water up to the bumper, punching tires and stuff. You know, they just kept on going. They went out and went across the lagoon and up on the hill. The timing was right because they got across before the big wave hit. They got up on the hill on the far side there. They looked back. My wife said, you know, saw this huge wave coming in. It came over the far breakwater. Picked the boat section, you know, the Celtic itself. You know, she says, the Celtic just came up. She went right over the top of that breakwater. Didn't even touch the breakwater. It's about a 9-10 foot breakwater. Went right over the top. The wave came, there was a railroad track between the boat harbor and the trailer court. Said it surged right over top of that and through the trailer court. Just things just, you know, just scattered all over the place. Found our trailer house in the lagoon. My mother's trailer house that was next to it, never found a sign of that. Up the house itself. Mm-hmm. Had a weird experience with that though. During the cleanup, my brother Bill had been killed by a switch engine just prior to the earthquake a year or so. And I had one of those autograph books that they had when he was in high school, they'd sign autograph books. Each kid would sign a little poem or something. And had a blue vase, about a 6-inch vase that belonged to my grandma Birch. And those two articles were found up in the debris by the airport, right together. Grandma Gertrude's vase, my brother Bill's autograph book, and no watermarks on the autograph book. And yet the house disappeared.
Disappeared, and it was in your mother's house.
Yeah, never stored there. Our place had a lean-to on it. Had a paneling on the wall, a little gun rack bolt into the studs. And they found up beyond the lagoon, up on Berry Hill, they found that wall lay in there. All the plywood, all the paneling stripped off of it. The gun rack still bolted two studs. And out of the six guns, four of them were still in the rack. I've got those at home yet.
It's amazing what a storm weird wave can do. And I imagine there's a massive cleanup effort.
Yeah. We started in on that right away. H&K came in, they had the contractor to clean up. Gave me an old international dump truck, a non-synchronized transmission. I started driving truck for them, and they barge loads of equipment started coming in. They brought brand new Ford dump trucks in. They must have liked the way I was working, because they gave me all the brand new Fords and gave that old international to somebody else. Ran that Ford for quite a while, a month I guess, and then they bought a barge load of brand new GMCs and gave me one of those. That was quite an experience. Things started getting organized when I first started. You know, we'd back up to a pile of debris and we'd all get out with the funeral help. Well, there towards the end, I was politely told that I was a truck driver. I was not a laborer, and I could not get off and load the truck. Mm-hmm. And sit in the cab until we tell you it's time to go. That got awful boring. About halfway through that cleanup, SBA had said they would finance boats, give disaster loans. The insurance company paid off on the Celtic, and we bought it back for $500. We had it insured for the $35,000 or so. You know, everybody got paid off. SBA came into town and said, you know, you want to buy a new boat? Yeah, we got to buy a new boat. Don't know what to do right now. We'll loan you the money to do it, 3%, which was real low in those days. Mm. $35,000 isn't really much to get started again. Well, you had equipment, didn't you? Yeah, we pulled up nets and stuff with all this gear. Well, you're going to need living expenses, aren't you? You're going to have to go outside to find a boat. Yeah, so you're going to need travel expenses. They worked it up. They loaned us $100,000. We went down to Orla, down to San Pedro first. He looked around and found Endeavor. He gave me a call. Come on out, we're going to rebuild the boat. Back up a little bit too, part of this history. When we had the Celtic, the same guy that had ran the Marigold up on the rock was deckhand for us. And he slammed the Celtic into Kane's head with Laura and I both on board. And he swears he was never on the boat. We took the Celtic back in. We had it laying on the beach there, putting a new bow stem in it so we could, or putting a false bow stem in it so we could get over to Kodiak here and go up on the way. It's just the only place to have a shipyard. There was a young guy sleeping under a skiff there. He was absolutely broke. gonna help you on your boat with the groceries. So we hired him to help us, gave him camera wages for helping us. Put the patch on, bought the self over here. They let us work on the boat too, so we kept him on. And he became our deckhand, worked with us, stayed with us for quite a while. And being that we weren't working at the time that typhoid hit, he wasn't with us. He helped with the cleanup. We went out to San Pedro to rebuild the boat. Like that, about 3 weeks later, he showed up down in San Pedro. I'm still looking for work. He says, you know, I sure like working with you guys. So we put him on for camera wages again, and we had to tank the boat and, you know, get ready to come up hard. He came up with us and fished with us, and out of Kodiak there, we started fishing shrimp with the Endeavor. We moved over here after the time we started fishing. For crab it was. There was no shrimp up this week. We'd get up and we'd fish a crab out of here. He went on and wanted to get into the business himself, so he bought an old boat. Oscar Dyson loaned him some plots. He started moving from there, and he now owns Trading Fisheries.
Great.
Chuck Munger. He's a good friend of ours. He's a tremendous success story.
Mm-hmm.
Real success story. Really, like the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Had some friends help him along the way to get started, and boy, he really went from there. We bought the Endeavor, converted it to crab. Came up here and started fishing crab for King Crab Incorporated. Poplin was 30 in those days. That's all you needed.
Mm-hmm.
The real good fishing spots that we found, we'd pick 30 pots one day, 15 the next, have a full load. Then you'd wait 10 days to unload.
Yeah.
It was a real boom in the crab. And the plants started gearing up for shrimp again. The Sonia and Old Harbor, they knew that we were shrimpers at heart. They asked us, you know, if we would re-rig the Endeavor to go shrimping for them. They wanted to get into it, which is fine. Dave Woodruff was running the Sonia at the time. We got the welders out and built stanchions and doors and ordered that out. I think we were getting a lot of Biloxi at that time. Started shrimping, and they found out that the Sonia wasn't a shrimp processor real quick. That didn't work too well, but we had the boat all rigged, ready to go. King Crab got in touch with us. They had a chance to sell shrimp, shrimp to a Korean partner, and wanted to know if we could deliver up to Fort Williams. They were delivering where you want. We started delivering up there. And then the process they had up there was they would blanch the shrimp, just dip them in boiling water for 90 seconds, and then freeze them in 20-pound onion sacks.
Mm-hmm.
And have a grain freighter that would come over and pick the product up. About 900,000 pound storage in that cold storage. Freighter all about a million. So they had it scheduled, and just as the storage was getting filled up, the freighter flew up. We keep delivering and trying to get it up to 1 million pounds for that freighter. Loaded that, about six of us start fishing up there. We loaded it. Probably loaded that freighter 7 or 8 times. The team crab, freighter hasn't left Korea yet. We're going to have to slow down. Got the 900,000 in storage. Made a couple more deliveries and really topped the whole story off. Then we had to quit. No freighter. Kept saying, well, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks. Freighter hasn't shown up yet.
Mm-hmm.
The following summer, we went on and done something else. got another job somewhere else. Following your king crab all this up. You know that shrimp up in Port Williams? You guys want a contract to handle that again? No way. That's an old, old time cold storage. Sawdust insulation. In order to get that much in there, you know, they didn't leave any corridors or anything. They just freeze the shrimp and stack it in there.
Yeah.
They had a mound, you know, 900,000 pounds of shrimp. And it started thawing up through that wooden floor. And it started rotting from the inside out. And when you went by Port Williams, you could smell that place. Now, we got a steady job. We don't want that. Ran the Endeavor. We worked for B&B Fisheries, delivered a lot of shrimp there. Xmonte was the first Japanese plant in town, joint venture with Tayo. Delivered a lot of shrimp there. Markets kept getting better and better. Vic said that he wanted some new boats, wanted more production, and helped finance, said if we could find a new boat, he would help us finance it. So, Laurel went down to, we got word that Bender had a fleet of southern shrimpers there that they couldn't sell. Laurel went down and took a look at that. That was in 1970. He gave me a call and said, come on down and take a look at the boats. Went down and had a 5 brand new 86 foot shrimpers there that they built for Columbia. People that were coming up the board, the whole damn board of the company was on the twin engine plane coming up from Columbia to pay for the boats, and they dumped the plane out in the Caribbean there. The company went bankrupt, and Bender was holding 5 brand new shrimpers. We told them we would take one if they would modify it for us. He wanted the southern rigging taken off, the masts and boom and stuff, you know, super heavy duty rigging put on before they argued with us. Waste of time. It's our money, we do it. And we told him to cut a slot in the shrimp. Oh, God. Just they couldn't believe it. So we cut the stern ramp into it. That was the first double rig. Stern ramp crawling in the world. There was one double rig crawler up here before us. It was over the side. After we got up here, it took us 68 days traveling time to come from Mobile, Alabama into Kodiak. We had a stop in Seattle for a while and had some work done to stop in Acapulco. Well, that was a mistake. Got arrested there. I don't like Mexico to this day. Called and called, and you're supposed to call in before you go into those ports. And we called. We couldn't get the answers on the radio. But we'd broken up lube oil ladder. We were out of lube oil. We had no choice. We had to go in. We went in and anchored. The port authorities came out. Said that they would get us the permits so we could do the work we needed to do. They did it about 3 or 4 days. We'd all been traveling back and forth on those little bumboats. You know, they said, you know, go ahead and go ashore if you want. So we did. We wandered around there about 3 or 4 days, couldn't get anything done. I mean, the newness of the place wore off, and it was time to go home. So Earl says, I'm going to go up to the gas station. I'm going to buy as many cans of oil as I can get my hands on. She goes to the grocery store and gets some fresh groceries. We got $43 worth of groceries. And I got back down to that little bumboat that we could use. They'd been charging us about 50 cents to ride. And the guy said, oh, go to jail. And all of a sudden, he couldn't talk English anymore. Well, I'm off the boat now. Dollar bill.
Oh, what's
it? I couldn't tell what was going on. guy that anywhere, anywhere his office was running up there. What's the problem? So these guys been buying stuff without permits. So they've been watching it. Just they knew that they were going to force us into doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll take you out to the boat and we'll see what we can do. We got on that little bumble. And let me take the groceries too. The boat out. Orla had already got out there. He got out there ahead of me. We come aboard. The guy says, need all your passports, ship's papers. And, you know, you're going to have to go in and answer to the authorities. He knew what was coming for us. Well, says, how much money you got? He counts us out. He had $60 left. I had $65. I gave him my $65. The crew was totally broke. He went on the bumble. Back into town they went. He got fined by the agriculture department. He got fined by the fisheries department. He got fined by the fuel department. He got fined by the customs department. Every office that they took oil to, there was a fine. And when he got back down to the boat, he had one $5 bill left. And back down to the bumble. Go back off the boat. Been paying about 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
$5. we got back on the boat. Had the port captain, or assistant captain, came back out. We were all free to go now. Yeah, you can leave. But he wouldn't get off the boat. He just sat in there. Oh, he was, you know, just talked and talked and talked. And, you know, we want to catch the tide. We want to get out of here. Boy, he just would not get off the boat. I knew he wanted something, so I went out and I broke the pins out of the hinges on the sea stores. And I didn't want to break the seal, but I knew how to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
I drove the pins out, got a couple of quarts of whiskey and a couple of cartons of cigarettes, put the pins back in the hinges, came down, handed him the cigarettes and whiskey on the boat, and away he went. We fired it up, and the back of Polk was just like a big crater with one entrance to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right in the middle of that crater, there's a gunboat that we had donated to Mexico, flying the Mexican flag. We had to get past that to get out. We're heading out, all of a sudden the speedboat comes out and starts zigzagging back and forth in front of us, trying to get us to stop. Well, I says, oh, God damn, we'll let that gunboat start shooting. We ain't stopping. And so the speedboat goes out in front of us. The guy tumbles off the stern, and the speedboat keeps going. So here's this guy flailing around in the water. We stop and pick him up, drag him aboard. One of our crewmen underneath these things got back in the corner with him and started tossing with him. Oil came down out of the wheelhouse. I don't know what the hell's going on. And he said, but I'm going to pass close to that head there. And he says, you can either go to California with us or you can jump off and swim ashore. Went back up, put her in there, and away we went. And the guy got on the stand again and started waving at that speedboat that's circling out there. Speedboat saw him off the stern. Speedboat came and picked him up. What we think was going on, I think that crew was trying to set up a red deal.
Mm-hmm.
And they were watching the boat too to see when they were going to leave. And we pulled out quite unexpected. And then I left, stopped in San Pedro, met with the people that had helped us rebuild the Endeavor. Well, got more lube oil so we could get on off that couple of girls. Almost got in trouble there. We forgot that we had to check back in with customers after being in the foreign port. Roger Brothers straightened us out on that, and the custom officials come down, checked us out. Said, boys, you guys are really lucky. You really lucky to get out of there. Western Union was closed down for somebody's been on strike or something. So generally what they do is they'll hold you and make you telegraph, you know, for $3,000 or $4,000 We'll go like, yeah. So you were really lucky that telegraph was on. Came on up to Seattle and did a little more work there. Came on over here to Kodiak and started fishing again. We'd left the Endeavor here with the skipper on it. He was still delivering shrimp. Got went out with Don. We'd never, ever, we hadn't worked double rig here at all. It was all kind of hitting us and experimenting with them. Within a week, we had a method routine put together that we could get. If we were 200 fathoms of cable, we could make a tow, start retrieving the gear. If there was less than 20,000 pounds of shrimp in each net, we could, out of 200 pounds of wire, we could retrieve both sides, put less than 20,000 out of each net, up to 20,000 out of each net, on deck, and have the gear back in the water in 38 minutes. And with the old boat, 40,000 would have taken us 6-7 hours to get it work. It was really revolutionized with the source. But, one time we put, with 23 hours dock there at B&B, we had 230,000 pounds of shrimp aboard 23 hours. Fix had a sliding window on his office up there, and we'd left at midnight, and we were back in at about 11 o'clock, tied at the dock again, sitting up there in the wheelhouse waiting for the unloaders to show up. Fix slides his window open. God damn you guys, he says, why didn't you get out of town? He says, I need that shrimp. And I didn't know he was sitting there with a full deck load.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an old muzzleloader replica Zouave. Used it to scare people with. It was loaded, and it was loaded full of toilet paper. That built it up with toilet paper. Standing in the wheelhouse store there, Vix's, you know, shoe was out, not going out. I just reached behind the door. God damn it, Vix, I had enough out of you. Oh, great big lot of black smoke and toilet paper goes flying up there. I guess he went clean back over the desk. Not sure as hell he got shot. We worked there and then put too many boats on and started putting us on limit. 80,000 pound limit, and he just couldn't do it. You know, he couldn't make ends meet at 80,000 pounds, 4 cents a pound. NEPCO had got into the shrimp by that time. They told us that they would pay Vix off the money we owed him. He'd loan us money to get going with the Don if we'd come out and work with them. We told Vix, you know, if you don't let us loose, you know, if you don't let us make full deliveries, we're going to have to leave. He didn't believe us. So we moved out to NEPCO. They gave us the money to pay Vix off. We worked there. They wanted more boats. You know, they were just getting into it. So they told us that they would buy us a boat. And they were going to put another boat on. And if we would get another boat, they would pay for it, and we would pay them back, no interest. So, 74, we found a pile of battery and picked up the dusk. Had it strengthened up, had the stern wrap put in it. Got her around. Fished out there quite a while, and things started going bad from NEPCO. They called our note, said they had to have the money. went down to MBA, and they financed the dust, you know, the water and water for that. And NEFCO eventually went bankrupt. We were, the shrimp was really going down, and the crab, everything was collapsing right at that time. We were starting to get in the pot and call it. New company bought out the bankruptcy there through a state loan. We started delivering both pollock and cod, emphasis on pollock. That was coming along real good, but through mismanagement that went to hell too. That company went bankrupt. And the joint venture started, that was the only market left. The owners didn't want any Alaskan wolves. They felt we were too small. Through political pressure, we forced them to hire Alaskan wolves. We didn't get on the early venture. We finally got on some of the later ventures, and the Alaskan boats proved they could do it. We ended up, we had probably 35, 40 Alaskan boats into the joint ventures. Part of the way we sold to the council is that, you know, we were 100% in favor of total surveys. By letting us do joint ventures with the foreigners, we would have the grounds developed. And by the time the surveys people came online, the cameras and stuff got geared up. And it worked quite well. We really gained a lot of knowledge there. And they were very lucrative, real good markets for venture days. And we did find out where all the fish were, mostly. But what happened is distant water fleet out of Seattle picked up on it a lot quicker than the shore-based plants in Alaska did, and they developed factory water fleet. Our plans for major developments in Alaska was too slow. We had no influence on the plants. We tried to make it as economically attractive as possible. We tried to create rules and regulations that would help the plants get going, but they were nervous about the investment. Through the state, we made arrangements that half of the raw fish tax, I'm not sure on the percentage, but I think that the plant owed raw fish tax, he could take 50% of that tax and purchase new equipment for his plant instead of giving it to the state. And that got quite a few people going, Kodiak Movie, All Last, and Swisher, APS, King Crab. He used a lot of that tax money to get in the bottom fish, and really help. I wish we had done it earlier, started. We phased the foreigners out, we phased the joint ventures out, and got back into the shore base mode, and then the factory callers were phasing us out. Real problem going right now. One factory crawler out there took 108 tons of caliber in 1 week. And we're only allowed 400 tons to support it.
Right.
And he really did a job on it. It's a real controversy going on that. But other things, you know, I got off the boats in 1977. The association here was broke. The manager had left. Association was quite important to the trawlers. My brother said that, you know, he and I talked it over, agreed that I'd donate 6 months of my time to seeing if I could get the association back on track again. We're elected a president at that time that was pretty dynamic, helped a lot. And I've been here ever since. We never did go back to the votes. The association itself is pretty involved in rules and regulations. We still negotiate price, but that used to be our prime reason for being. With all of the changes in the laws and the regulations, and working with the Coast Guard on the Coast Guard requirements, safety rules, working with national inspectors on borders and stuff like that, that's the main part of our business now, is keeping track of all that. You know, this packet that I put together here in mind, the definition of a pledge for all the, all the, when the additional closed areas on the island, Federal Register notice that has all of the maps of the 20 mile closures, sending all that out to all the members. The new announcements when the dates are going to be, the new Coast Guard rules for prohibit operating a vessel while intoxicated. I do a lot of that, making sure the guys are notified, but it's really hard to keep up on that.
Do you expect to see the shrimp come back?
We watch the surveys pretty close. Ron Kuchik's running the resolution now. He ran the desk for us for a number of years. And shrimp and bottom fish. So real confident skipper, real good man. Has lent a lot of credibility to